Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America was famously, and for a long time, the instant gratification society. See it, want it, have it, and worry about the consequences, the bill, later. Now an economic hurricane is forcing delayed gratification on a whole country. There's science on the difference that goes way back and is really interesting. This hour, On Point, we'll get a top psychologist and economic historian talking about challenge and willpower in the new American economy. You can join the conversation. The party's over for now. Do we still have the muscles for delayed gratification and self-control? Do you feel your appetite changing from have it all right now to something else? Will we be better off with a little more self-denial or just poorer? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Jonah Lehrer, contributing editor at Wired and author of How We Decide, and Proust Was a Neuroscientist. His wonderful new piece in this week's New Yorker is Don't, The Secret of Self-Control. Jonah Lehrer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You call guys at the New Yorker all sound like Malcolm Gladwell these days. Don't? Is that going to be your book after Blink and all the rest? All these sort of high-concept how-to-live books?
I can't take credit for the title, I'm afraid.
Okay. You've dived in here to the science that goes back four or five decades now. One sort of strand that started out with what looked like a simple experiment about kids and marshmallows in the mid-60s, and now sitting here in 2009, it seems incredibly relevant to our whole society. We're going to hear from the psychologist who mounted that, Walter Mischel, and from a top economic historian, Richard Cilla. But introduce us first to some of this research that goes way back now on delayed gratification, self-control. Take us in, Jonah.
This is a classic experiment done by Walter Mischel. He began in 1968 at the Bing Nursery School in Stanford University, and the experiment was quite simple. He'd bring a four-year-old into a game room, as they're known. It's a small room with a large one-way mirror, and he'd make these four-year-olds an offer. He'd say, you can have one marshmallow right away, and he offered them marshmallows, Oreo cookies, pretzel sticks, or if the kids could wait while he ran an errand, they could have a second marshmallow or a second Oreo cookie. And he gave them a bell and said, you know, if any time you get tired of waiting, just ring this bell and I'll come running back and you can eat the one marshmallow. But you're forfeiting your chance for a second marshmallow.
So there's a four-year-old in an empty room with a marshmallow right in front of him or her on the table. He's gone. They can eat it.
The scientists are behind the one-way mirror watching the kid. But the kid thinks he's all alone. And so not surprisingly, just about every kid decides to wait. They want the second marshmallow or the second Oreo cookie.
Two is better than one.
Absolutely. But here's where you see this wide variation in terms of how long kids can actually wait. That some kids would ring the bell as soon as Walter left the room. Some kids could wait 30
seconds.
And
ringing the bell meant, come back, I want to eat it now?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I can't wait. I can't delay any longer. I need this marshmallow right now. It's so delicious and staring me right in the face. Right. I need to pop into my mouth. So some kids could wait 2 minutes. The average waiting time in the original Bing studies was about 2.5 minutes. And some kids, though, could actually wait the full 15 minutes. And interestingly, Walter's theory, and this was based on hundreds of hours of observation, was that the kids who could delay, these were the high delayers, that they weren't better at gritting their teeth. They didn't have more willpower per se. What they were much better at was actually distracting themselves, what Walter calls the strategic allocation of attention. They were the kids who would turn their back on the marshmallow. They would sing songs from Sesame Street. They would play a game with their shoelaces. They would pretend to fall asleep. They realized,
daydream, look away, anything, but not just staring and salivating over that poor single marshmallow.
Yes,
on the table.
Which Walter calls the hot stimulus. And they knew that if they were thinking about the hot stimulus, they were going to eat that marshmallow. So the key was to temporarily forget all about the delicious snack sitting right in front of them.
If they waited 15 minutes, he came back in, they got the second marshmallow, they were the big winners. They got twice as much as everybody else.
Absolutely.
And then, I mean, this was interesting in itself, but as you write in the New Yorker this week, he comes back decades later, or years and then decades later, and looks in on how these kids, now adults, fared in life, and there's a pattern.
Yeah, he sent out an exhaustive questionnaire when these kids were high school seniors and found that the high delayers, the kids who could wait at the age of four for a second marshmallow, this very simple, straightforward task, that they got along better with their friends. They had fewer behavioral problems in school. They were less likely to do drugs. They got much higher scores in the SAT. The difference between The difference between a kid who could wait 30 seconds and a kid who could wait 15 minutes was the kid who could wait 15 minutes had an SAT score that was 210 points higher than the kid who couldn't wait. So a dramatic difference. It turns out that the marshmallow task is just about the most predictive test you can give a four-year-old. In fact, it's much more predictive than the IQ test given to a four-year-old at predicting all these outcomes.
Meaning that, I'm not sure what to call it, willpower, self-control is more predictive of success in life than raw IQ.
Well, at the age of four. So, the reason is because the same cognitive skills that allow you to wait for a marshmallow when you're four, realizing that I've got to distract myself if I want to accomplish my goal, which is getting a second marshmallow, those are the same skills that when you're in high school say, you know, I'd love to watch my favorite television shows on, but I got to study for a test. And so they also allow you to study for a test. They also allow you to put money in your 401k. This is a very, it turns out to be a very important cognitive skill, being able to direct your attention so that you can resist, you know, the temptation sitting right in front of you in the service of a long-term goal.
We're going to talk with Walter Michel, the psychologist who ran this experiment all those years ago and has followed it through and is now even looking at preparing to go in with the MRI and examine the very brains of people who can do that. And we're going to hear from an economic historian in just a couple of minutes. But, Jonah, how do you see the relevance of all this research, all this insight to the sort of national challenge today? I mean, the cookie jar has been taken away. We have no choice at some level. But at another level, individuals are still going to have to figure out how to respond to this.
Well, I think one very interesting implication is that, you know, the easy, I think, conclusion to draw from Walter's work is that, oh, this must be personality's most predetermined. Some people are simply born with genes that allow them to delay or not delay. And I think, you know, I would be very suspect of such an easy conclusion. I think Walter's also shown in studies with kids in the South Bronx and also his Stanford studies that if you teach a low delay, if you teach a four-year-old who couldn't even wait 30 seconds, if you teach them a simple set of cognitive strategies, if you simply show them, why don't you pretend the marshmallow's a cloud? Why don't you draw a picture frame around the marshmallow? Then now all of a sudden a kid who couldn't wait at all can now wait 18 minutes. So I think
you can build the muscle.
You can build these self-control muscles. You can teach kids very, very simple tricks and have big, you know, and have big consequences later on.
I wonder if that can be done nationally. I'm looking here at a comment in the Weekend Australian of all places not long ago. It says, delayed gratification is as alien to 21st century children as darning socks. They said the ravages of four decades of narcissism cannot be quickly undone. What do you think?
But Walter and his colleagues are now going into a variety of charter schools and private schools, actually conducting a longitudinal experiment to see if you can teach kids between the ages of 4 and 8 these simple strategies, and then if, you know, whether or not these skills generalize. So whether or not you can teach a kid these strategies in the classroom, then when they get home and have to resist the allure of television, they can also delay gratification then too. So that remains unknown, whether or not we can take kids who have perhaps lost these skills, whether, you know, we as a culture have lost these skills, and actually through interventions in the classroom at a young age actually get those skills back.
Let's get an economic historian in here with us. We'll hear from the psychologist in just a minute. But joining us right now from New York is Richard Silla, professor of economics at New York University's Stern School of Business, author of The American Capital Market and A History of Interest Rates. This is a guy who knows cycles in the American economy. Professor Silla, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
So I'm looking here at a story I heard on public radio recently about Costco. And, you know, they're still selling the basics, which they sell cheap like crazy, but they're having trouble this spring because consumers are not coming in while they're buying toilet paper and, you know, bacon and eggs, and also just snagging the stuff that they normally would, like just pick up a patio heater or a flat screen TV or barbecue grill or case of Bordeaux. Consumers aren't doing that. Does that mean that we're already practicing delayed gratification in the real economy, Richard Silla?
I think it's coming back, Tom. The consumers have been shocked by the financial crisis and now the economic slowdown. Our savings rate had gone about to zero, meaning we were spending just about everything we earned. And now we found that our asset values have gone down, the stock market's down, the house is down in price. And I think people are saying, hey, we overdid it. It's time to get back to the right living. And people are staying out of the stores and trying to build up their savings. We've already detected a jump upward in the savings rate in the United States.
What's your explanation for what the Australian calls four decades of narcissism, of those many years in which the savings rate fell and fell and fell in this country, and we our reputation came to be the country that wants instant gratification all the time?
Well, I think the Americans are used to a rising standard of living. It's been going on since the beginning of the country more than 200 years ago. And certain things happened. I mean, the economy's generally been prosperous in the last three or four decades. But, you know, something happened around 1990 with the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and even earlier, countries like India and China had kind of opened up to the world more. And suddenly, workers in the United States found that they had to compete with labor all over the world. So their wages didn't go up so fast, and their median family incomes didn't go up so fast, but they decided they wanted to have a rising standard of living. And they found that they could do that, even though wages weren't going up, by home equity loans, you know, extract some of the equity from your house and buy a new car.
Spend it now.
Or the rising stock market, even, you know, was the 401k plans. Well, my 401k is up, so I don't really need to save anything. And I think, you know, that's kind of why we got into the unusual situation where we saved just about nothing in recent years.
But it's not as though people are expecting that wages are going to be going up rapidly anytime soon. Do we need calisthenics for self-control? Do we need to sort of practice, build those muscles? As an economist, do you look at it that way, Richard Silla?
Well, I think there's something to that. I was fascinated by reading Jonah's article in The New Yorker because, you know, Americans have gotten in the habit of when they have nothing to do on a weekend or even evening, go to the store, and the store is full of temptations. It's almost like that marshmallow there.
Yep.
And you see something you didn't expect to see, and you say, well, that's pretty interesting. I'll buy that. And so the conclusion I drew was if people really do want to save more, they need to distract themselves. You know, watch the baseball game or have a chat with the family, do a puzzle.
Anything but spend, at least for a little while here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about instant gratification, delayed gratification, and the big shift underway in the U.S. right now. It's psychological, it's economic, and it may be key to our national future. Jonah Lehrer is with us, contributing editor at Wired, author of a wonderful new piece in this week's New Yorker called Don't, The Secret of Self-Control. It's all about the psychological experiments of the great psychologist Walter Mischel, who will join us in just a moment. Richard Silla is with us, professor of economics at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's followed Americans for a long time on this front, patterns of spending and self-denial. Let's hear from a couple listeners. Josh in Exeter, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Josh.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
You too.
So I think, you know, one thing I've tried to do, and I think the marshmallow study is a perfect analog to this, is definitely, you know, delay gratification. And what it gives me a chance to do not only is to, you know, obviously save more money to what I'm going to buy, but also, you know, think twice about what I'm going to buy and try to find a better product that will last a little longer.
But does that feel good, or would it feel better just to have the darn thing right now, even if it wasn't perfect, even if you couldn't afford it?
Well, I guess I do give in every once in a while and just go for whatever I want at the time. But it does feel good when I end up with something that I'm happy with and that I know will, you know, probably be better than what I would have gotten if I had gotten it right away.
So there's a vote for it and for a little more careful eye about what is snatched up. Thanks, Josh. Let's go to Phil in Nashville, Tennessee. Phil, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Phil.
Yes, my thought was I'm glad to hear that American consumers are picking up the spending and not doing so much immediate spending, or picking up the saving and not so much immediate spending of money they don't have. I'm concerned that the federal government seems to be taking the opposite approach right now, which is not, I don't think it's unique to this administration, and I guess there's some support in the Keynesian economic point of view, but I think it's just...
But the deficit budget is bigger than ever.
That we got into a lot of trouble with Americans spending money they didn't have, and that got us into a mess, and now the way to get out of it is for the federal government to spend money it doesn't have.
So there's the personal and the public with John Cain standing right in the middle as a question mark. Thanks, Phil, in Nashville. And one more from Providence, Rhode Island, Clementina. Hi, Clementina. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just stepped out of Target, where I usually go once a week, and I can never get out of there without spending $300. And, of course, you know, with the economy today, I was buying my essentials, and I stepped out. I turned on the radio you're on, and I had spent $200, $100 less, but still $100 more of unnecessary stuff.
Yeah.
And I turned on the radio, and I'm like, okay, after this radio show, I'm turning around and I'm returning all that stuff that I really didn't need. I find it still very hard, even after 6 months of cutting back, to not have that instant gratification, to not go into Target full of stuff that you don't really, really need, buy my essentials, and I still put in a few things for instant gratification. But now I'm, like, turning around and then just returning that stuff.
What did you buy today, Clementina, that you're going to return when the show's over, that marched right back into Target? I'm sorry, Target, but what are you going to take back?
I'm going to take back a long-sleeve jean jacket that I definitely don't need in this beautiful New England weather today,
right.
And a couple of T-shirts that probably are not age-appropriate anyway for me to wear.
But they look pretty snacky. They look pretty desirable on the hanger.
They did, and they did make me feel young when I tried them on, but then I said, you know what? I can't wear those things. I don't know why. I keep them in my closet, and I never wear them anyway.
Clementina, you're great, and our apologies to Target for the returns and maybe to the economy, which consumers float, but you got the message straight on there. Thanks so much for calling. Jonah Lehrer and Richard Silla, please stand by for a second. We're joined now, also from New York, by Walter Michel, professor in the psychology department at Columbia University, author of the groundbreaking work way back in 1968, Personality and Assessment. He pioneered all kinds of work on this front of delayed gratification, pioneered the marshmallow experiments in the 1960s, studying delayed gratification and self-control in children. Real landmark work here that's got great relevance right now. Walter Michel, thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You've done a lifetime of research on this front, and now here's the nation. You see the spot it's in. What do we need to know about what you've learned about self-control? What do we most need to know? Boil it down for us.
Well, trying to boil it down, it's really that normally, particularly in our culture, because as Richard pointed out earlier, we've been used to really going on credit and enjoying the immediate things that we can have, the flat-screen television and so on. And there's that kind of behavior is really sustained by something that happens to all of us because it's part of how the mind and the brain work, which is we do what's called temporal discounting, which means we pay much less weight normally to events in the future,
mm-hmm.
like the cancer that I could get 40, 50 years or whatever down the line if I keep doing things that aren't
smoking.
Good for me.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're really focused on, and our brain and our mind disposes us towards that, are the gratifications and the fears, both the pleasures and the pains of the moment, because that's what nature made us good for in the course of development. So in order to shift that, we have to make the distal consequences, the delayed consequences, more vivid, more emotionally hot. We have to bring them, in a sense, from our primitive brain up to our front brain, to the frontal areas of what we're able to do. Now, in that process of heating up the delayed consequences, there are all kinds of things that are happening in the economy now that heat them up. For example, seeing foreclosure signs on the news.
Yeah.
Seeing unemployment lines, seeing people who are not that different from yourself, who are not like yourself, being kicked out of their homes. And when you see the foreclosure signs in your own neighborhood, it's even more vivid. So what I think we're seeing happening, and what the economists are describing quite correctly, is a shift towards greater saving, because first of all, people are having less money, and secondly, they're more aware of the fact that they may have even less very, very soon. And things that used to be abstractions are now becoming very hot, emotional, vivid, panic conditions.
Is everybody equipped to make this shift from instant gratification to delayed? I mean, you tested four-year-olds. You followed them through life. I mean, if I was one of the kids who grabbed the marshmallow in 10 seconds when I was four, if I'm 40 now, do I have the capacity to become a, you know, Mr. Self-Control?
Well, the encouraging news on that is something that Jonah mentioned very, very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just try to repeat it, which is that we know in our research that if we just cue a child who has an enormous amount of difficulty waiting for anything to think differently about the object of desire, to cool it, for example, by in your head, just put a frame around it, make believe it's just a picture. As mm-hmm. Jonah mentioned, that child is then able to wait a lot longer than he would have otherwise. Now, what we don't know is how readily we can teach this and whether or not it can stick. We're going to try to do it, and the earlier in life I think that it begins, the better. We're going to try to do it with children who are 4 to 8. But I have to tell you that at the moment, the answer to how teachable is this, how well does it stick, is really not known.
Fascinating.
But I think it's certainly worth trying.
Mm. Richard Silla, I wonder how you hear all this as an economist. You know the economic history. You know the sort of waves of more and less spending through American history. Do you think of this as an economist? Well, never mind the psychology. There's just certain parameters, a certain range in which American spending and saving flow, and these are immutable. Or do you look at these as elements for, I don't know, massive social engineering?
Well, I think that Americans can change. I remember a little known incident for most of us forgotten, but back in 1980, Jimmy Carter was worried about inflation, and he went on TV and told Americans to tear up their credit cards, and the government would have a program of, you know, kind of controlling credit. Mm-hmm. And Americans responded to that almost too much because they stopped spending, and the bottom started falling out of the economy, and so the Federal Reserve had to act quickly and prevent the bottom from falling out of the economy. Mm-hmm. But I think it fell enough to ensure that President Reagan defeated President Carter that in the election that year. So Americans can change. I think the current crisis is causing them to, you know, kind of think that maybe they should save more. And temporarily, this is kind of responding to your listener in Nashville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
As Americans are cutting back on spending, if we don't want the bottom to fall out of the economy, the federal government has to have some of these increased spending programs, because in the 1930s, consumers stopped spending and the government didn't do anything, and we had a Great Depression. So I think we're doing some, the government is doing some of the things that are raising questions about the future for pretty good reasons right now. It's part of the offsetting the negative effects of the reduced consumer spending and rise in the savings rate.
But for individual consumers, you're suggesting it makes a difference whether, let's say, the president is saying cut up your credit cards or go shopping.
Well, I think so. American, that's what 1980 taught me, that, you know, a leader can have a strong effect. I think when you go back to 1933, President Roosevelt said, you can trust the banks, put your money back in the banks. Americans immediately did that. They responded to President Carter. Nobody said, save more now at the top level of the government, but the word is out that people can probably benefit by saving more, and Professor Michelle gave us some good reasons. Like, you notice that your neighbor becomes unemployed. That's what we call a recession. If you become unemployed, it's a depression. People are responding to things they see by, you know, kind of saying it would be a good idea to have a little money in the bank, so I better not go to the store and spend it all right now because I really may need that money to buy food down the road.
The knife at the throat can be very persuasive. We've got a lot of questions and comments here from listeners. John in Andover, Massachusetts. You're on the air, John.
Hi. Well, I think that the lessons that you learn from your parents are a greater influence than marshmallows. If you have a parent that grew up through the Depression, you'll be a saver. I guarantee it. I know that my father-in-law was a Depression baby, and he has a closet filled with shoes now. He tends to hoard things. And I feel like I don't think anybody would question that your parents are the most influential force in your life when you're four.
Yeah, John, let us pick that up, because of course that's fascinating, because kids growing up right now, their parents would be the ones who are absolutely the mega celebrants of buy it now, instant gratification. Walter Michel, In your research, what do you find about the impact of parents on kids? Do parents follow in the footsteps of their kids on self-control?
Or the other way around? I think there's no question that what we learn and what we have modeled for us, what we see our parents doing, what we see our peers doing, enormously influences what we do ourselves. I think the good news on the question of can we change our spending habits, either in the direction of spending less or spending more, I think we can, because if there's a main finding that comes not just out of my research, but out of psychology in the last 30, 40 years, it's that the human mind has far more plasticity, just like cultures have far more plasticity than one might have believed. If you look even at cultures like China and Poland and so on, and that the immense changes that they have gone through with regard to economic behavior and with regard to social behavior. I think it's evidence at the group level of something we see always at the level of the individual, which is people can change, they do change. We're adaptive creatures. We're creatures of nature and of evolution, and we're made to be adaptive. So when the consequences change, when the circumstances change, we change. Some people are faster at it than others, and some people are slower at it than others. But that, again, there are endless sources of influence that can impact on that, and Richard spoke about some of them. Some of our phone guests have spoken about others. There are many more.
Joan O'Leary, you're kind of our civilian who's really dug into Walter Mischel's work. Do you come out optimistic about the country's capacity to make this shift? And he talks about, you know, who's more or less adaptive individually. I mean, is it your sense that those who are most adaptive here are going to be the winners in this new economy, or is everybody just kind of settling down to a more modest life?
Well, I think one important thing to keep in mind is that even as we try to shift to becoming a nation of high delayers, is that we've built all these financial innovations into our system, things like credit cards, things like subprime mortgages, that I think make it harder for us to delay. There's some suggestive work by George Lowenstein and Brian Knutson, two neuroeconomists, that actually show that when people pay with credit cards, when people buy things with credit cards, their brain treats it differently than as if they were paying with cash. That because the transaction's abstract, because you're not literally taking cold hard
really
cash out of your
that.
Wallet, you're just swiping a plastic thing and the bill will show up in 30 days, that your brain doesn't fully process the pain of payment until you end up spending too much money. So I think it's not simply a matter of shifting to a nation of high delayers. I think we've also made it harder for ourselves to become high delayers, to actually resist the allure of the, you know, long sleeve jean jacket in Target.
Right.
That it's not simply as, you know, unfortunately, it's not simple as really trying to become high delayers, that we also have to cut up our credit cards or at least put them in a block of ice in the freezer.
Richard Cilla, what about it? We've engineered high spending with all kinds of fancy finance. Do we need to re-engineer in the other direction? You know, beyond just the simple, beyond psychological encouragement. Do you think it takes structural change in the economy and finance for Americans to kind of get a full grip on this?
Definitely. You know, we've had this financial crisis now. I agree with Jonah that the financial system, Wall Street, if you like, made it very easy for us to engage in instant gratification by allowing us to take the equity out of our homes or borrow against our increasing 401ks. And I think Wall Street has let us down a little bit now, which is probably why we're changing. I mean, people have found that house prices don't always go up and that the stock market can fall 50% in a fairly short period of time. So I think that, you know, and I think as we know that Wall Street maybe overdid it, just like American consumers overdid it, and we're likely coming out of this financial crisis and recession to think about reforms to make sure that Wall Street doesn't get too creative in a sense that can damage the economy. And I think, you know, Americans are looking at all this and saying it's probably time to cut back a little bit and get to the traditional ways of saving some money. And of course, I have to point out that if you do save more money, I mean, you will, in fact, get those two marshmallows down the road.
Right,
you know, they do come. And so, you know, there's a lot of security that comes from saving.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about instant gratification, delayed gratification, and the big shift underway in the U.S. right now. It's psychological and economic, and it may be very important to our national future, personal futures. We've been joined this hour by Joan O'Leary with a great news story in the New Yorker magazine this week, largely about the research of Walter Mischel, pioneering psychologist, professor of psychology at the department in the psychology department at Columbia University now. He joins us today from New York, as does Richard Cilla, economic historian, professor of economics at New York University's Stern School
of business. They know this inside and out, but from different angles. There's a lot of science unfolding right in front of us here. Let's get a call from Detroit, Michigan, and Asia. Hi, Asia. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is about prioritizing versus delayed gratification. If there is a difference, if it's sort of the same thing. When we were growing up, my siblings and I, my parents, or rather my mother mostly, gave us the choice. You know, I want these jeans. Well, do you want these jeans or do you want to go to summer camp? And I feel like it's the same sort of thing. Maybe I didn't always have the newest clothes, but I got to go on vacation in the summer. So I don't know if it's sort of in the same category as the lead.
Yeah, no, I like that. She helped you frame it in terms of prioritization. Walter Michel, what do you hear in Asia's, you know, childhood lesson from her mother and her question about prioritizing versus simple delay?
Well, I think it speaks directly to the point and to the discussion. That is the recognition that there are consequences to your immediate choices as well as consequences to your delayed choices is enormously important. And what the caller just described is a parent who is very good at making that clear to her child. From the beginnings of life. So I think this is a very, very good example of how what in jargon one refers to as learning about the contingencies, the if-then relationship between mm-hmm. what you buy, what you choose, what you take, and what you get in terms of what you win or lose mm-hmm. in the long-term consequences. So I think that very much speaks to the question and identifies one of the important conditions through which people learn that delay of gratification and immediate gratification each have their costs and their consequences.
Richard Silla, as an economist listening there, I mean, a lot of American families are having to reprioritize or to more stringently prioritize right now. I mean, do you anticipate a change in the profile of spending as Americans, you know, think, well, we can't have it all. We have to prioritize. It's surely going to change the profile of their sort of economic life.
Well, I think, you know, economics is, we call ourselves the science of how people make choices. The world's resources are scarce and our needs seem to be unlimited. And so we have to make choices given that we live in a world of scarcity. And I think the kind of changes that we may be in the process of making are not something brand new. They're more like a return to the way Americans behave through most of our history. We, you know, at many parts of our history, we were a high-saving nation. After mm-hmm. all, we built the world's largest economy by saving and investing our money. And I think, you know, it's just that we, in recent years, recent decades, it's been so easy to live the high consumption style and still feel like you were providing for the future mm-hmm. because the stock market rose, the house rose in price. And I think we're finding out now that, you know, house prices don't always go up. And so I suspect that we will move back toward more delayed gratification. And it's just a return to earlier American traditions, not something brand new.
Joan Allaire, as you looked into this research, I wonder if you found yourself thinking about a redefinition of what winning is. I mean, the old sort of, what, 80s, 90s bumper sticker was, you know, the one with the most toys, right? But I'm reading in your piece here, Walter Michel and his colleagues, you know, finding all kinds of sort of payoffs for delayed gratification. They weren't all about who had the biggest house or the fanciest car. They were kind of lifestyle, quality of life payoffs that weren't purely economic as I read them.
Yeah, no, and that I think is some of the most surprising implications of this work is that it's not simply the higher SAT score. It's also you get along better with other people. So and that I think also speaks to the fact that what we think about as willpower actually cashes out in the real world as a very fundamental mental skill, which is being able to allocate your attention, being able to control the contents of your own mind, control what you're thinking about. And that turns out to have big consequences in terms of when you get upset, can you control your temper? Do you know how to, you know, count to 10 and take deep breaths so you don't, you know, start shouting at your wife or husband. So this isn't simply about waiting for that second marshmallow. I think this is also about saving for your 401k and learning how to deal with other people, learning how to control these hot emotions when these emotions might be leading us astray.
But as I read it, it's sort of the difference between going through life
whipsawed by emotion and desire versus with self-control, as you say, a little more sense of agency, a sense of, hey, I'm steering this life where I want it to go, quite apart from some of those externals.
If I can join in on this.
Yes, please.
Tom, you said it exactly right. It's avoiding, it's learning to not be buffeted by whatever tantalizing goodie is in front of you, and to make decisions that are long-term and short-term really better for you. And one of the reasons that I say that is because those consequences that Jonah was referring to that go with a pattern of ability to delay gratification, which doesn't mean you delay gratification all the time. You just know how to do it when you need to do it, want to do it. And you want to do it more often when you recognize that a lot of the things that are tempting are really not good for you. And those consequences, long-term consequences, include things like a lot lower body mass index, which means you get less weight, which means you also wind up healthier. And we think that that's happening not only in terms of physical health, but also in terms of psychological health. You tend to have fewer problems of all kinds. You tend to develop fewer symptoms that one might otherwise be prone to of a variety of disorders. So to me, one of the most exciting consequences of the work is that it doesn't just affect things related to mental abilities. It doesn't just affect SAT scores. It seems to be related to a whole pattern of consequences. And one more point that I think is very important, because we've all been talking about, can people change? Are you kind of stuck with this willpower thing as something you've got from birth and it just stays with you and you're either blessed or you're not? To me, the most interesting group, and Jonah mentions it briefly in his article, is the group that we've studied for over 40 years now that began very low in delay of gratification, who didn't wait for the cookie or for the marshmallow, who rang the bell fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then in each measurement, every 8 to 10 years, they got a little better at delay of gratification. They became more adaptive, not less adaptive. So something can happen to people even when they're starting rather low for whatever reasons, whether parenting or whether peers or whatever the reason, and they can change. So identifying those conditions that enable change and that allow people to use their brains and their minds and to live their lives with the kind of flexibility that human beings are capable of, that's, I think, really the challenge. So I think there's no question that people can change and that they do change with regard to delay ability. The question really is, how can that be facilitated in how we parent, in how we school our children, and in how we model and live our own lives?
This raises all kinds of interesting economic questions in a country where 70% of our economy has been consumer spending. But let me hold that for just a moment, because we've got one of our callers on just this front of change over time, Mason City, Iowa. Christy, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm calling with a comment on the marshmallow story. I am a 40-year-old woman that has not ever had any financial problems, totally live within my means. The willpower issue is an emotional one for me. And as a 40-year-old, I have come to terms that I can sing my Sesame Street song and I can wait for my second marshmallow, whereas the 4-year-old, I would have been the one eating it within 2 minutes.
With maybe even 30. So you would have been the one quick to grab the marshmallow and eat it, but you've changed, and you say that willpower is an emotional issue for you, Christy. And I almost hear you tear up a little bit when you say that. What do you mean by that?
You know, circumstances change, and people have to grow, and people have to adapt. And I just wanted to confirm that your guests are completely correct in that.
It sounds like you had to take some lumps along the way. It was sort of a hard learning curve. Maybe it will be for the whole country.
Yes. And I have learned it. I'm very content singing my Sesame Street song right now.
We're glad you've got it. And life is growth, and you've got it, Christy. Thanks for that. Let's get a call from Waltham, Massachusetts. And John, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I was really interested in what Dr. Michelle was saying just a couple of minutes ago about, I was one of the kids who, for a variety of reasons, was very you know, I needed what I wanted now. I grew up in a rather, you know, working class family where there was a lot of deprivation, and I became addicted to stuff, collecting records, buying books, being a voracious reader, but I failed in school. I had no sense of delayed gratification at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think stuff filled a void, filled a sense of disorder that I, eased a sense of disorder and chaos that I was experiencing, and eventually led to addiction. I think addiction is in some ways the ultimate consumer, you know, drugs or alcohol or sex addiction are sort of the ultimate consumer good. And in struggling with addiction, I think one of the ways that we, recover out of those things is that eventually the negatives outweigh the positives. The negatives of overspending to get what you want, to fill that void, eventually you go into tremendous debt. The negative consequences of being addicted for several years include the fact that you get sick. It no longer works. It no longer fills that void. It no longer eases that sense of chaos. And so you have to adapt, in whatever personal ways that you can, through therapy or through experience or what have you. But for me, both the indulgence and, lack of patience that I experienced as a child, and, my evolution into, I guess, a much more patient and a much more sort of self-possessed, self-contained person than I am now are both sort of coping mechanisms.
But it sounds like the ditch was deep along the way. I mean, those negative consequences, whether personal, maybe some in your case, John, or national for us right now, can be really severe before the tide turns, before the pendulum swings. That is great and subtle testimony right there. Let me twin it up, if I may, Walter Michelle. Here's a question from the website, kind of related. It says, in real life, people are often resistant to good advice that would help them forego immediate gratification, obtain long-term benefit. Can you comment on what controls the higher-order judgment that people make about whether or not to pay attention to advice, how to reach our goals? I mean, where do you trace that down to, Walter Michelle?
I think the question has to do with how do you manage to cool the hot temptation? That is, what is the ability that allows you to use your brain, your forebrain, the part that really can solve problem and think about future consequences.
Mm-hmm.
How can you activate that part when what's pulling at you is how tempting that chocolate cake on the dessert tray that the waiter is bringing around is, how tempting it is, or how powerful that drug you'd love to inhale might be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I think that requires is being able to do something that human beings actually have the ability to do, which is to change how they think about the object that they're looking at or that they're being tempted with. We saw that in the lady who called in and was talking about her experience at the Target store.
Mm-hmm.
So people naturally do it all the time, which is they're able to, because they hear something or they see something, to change the way in which they represent the object of desire to make it less desirable.
But if I may, Richard Silla, this seems to me to go right to the heart of things, because we do have an economy that's 70% based on consumer spending. We have spent decades absolutely perfecting the art of making everything a hot temptation. I mean, this seems to me that the fundamental construct of the American economy now. How do you step away from that and still have an economy that will recognize?
Well, I think that we can step away from it. We can, if we don't spend so much, we save a little more. And the more we save, probably the faster the economy grows, because what we save goes into investment. So it's not all that clear. You mentioned the 70%. I think the 70% consumption can be consistent with low savings or high savings. And we can have
explain that. How do you have higher savings and still sustain that kind of consumption? Based on deficit, personal deficit spending, credit cards, and all the rest?
Well, no, I think when we save more, there's more money that goes into investment. We build more factories, more highways, and so on. And the economy then tends to grow faster. So we have a larger pie, and we can still consume 70% of it and have a rising standard of living. If we don't save so much, then the economy doesn't grow as fast, and then our standard of living doesn't go up. So I think that it's economic growth, really, which is what's propelled America to its forefront of the world. And we can change. And I would mention that behavioral economists have found ways of causing us to change. For example, when people take a job, sometimes they're offered a 401k plan with perhaps an employer match. And we found that if they have to pick, say, I want to opt into that plan, not so many people do. So some behavioral economists said, let's suppose the employer says you're in the plan unless you opt out. And the very same people then stayed in the plan.
A little re-engineering.
We can re-engineer our economy.
Joan Allaire, you've dug in deeper than I have by a long shot right here. Did you come out optimistic from your sort of tour through the world of delayed gratification, high delayer science, or not, for the country?
Definitely. For all the reasons Walter said, it's that people are plastic creatures. We are malleable. We can learn to change.
Here we are in the cauldron of change and learning about it as we go. This has really been fascinating. Joan Allaire, thank you so much for the article in The New Yorker. Really terrific.
Thank you.
Walter Michel, thanks for all your research, and thank you for being with us today, sir.
Thanks very much.
And Richard Silla for the big economic picture. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.